Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is Alex Lieberman. And the reason why I wanted to bring Alex on is because I wanted to get a deeper understanding of who Alex is as a human being. I listened to a bunch of other podcasts he was on, and it was the same story over and over again of how Morning Brew got started. Morning Brew is an email newsletter that has more than 2.5 million subscribers. And so it was cool to learn about his story in other podcasts. But in this conversation, I wanted to know, who is Alex Lieberman? And you got a real sense. After speaking to him, I just felt a level of connection with him. And conversations like this are why I started the podcast to begin with. We went into Alex's father's passing and how that affected him. We went into deep psychological things that he's been thinking about and working on himself. So I really think you're going to enjoy this conversation. And if you do, let me know on Twitter at Hey Danny Miranda. But now let's get into the conversation with Alex Lieberman.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
Alex, thank you for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I'd love to start off the conversation with the quote, "Be the best trader you can be." What's the origin of that?
Be the best trader you can be. So that was the line that I had written up on my whiteboard in my room growing up in my childhood home. Probably from the time I was like 13 years old until I no longer lived in my home. And the backstory is my parents worked in sales and trading. My grandpa worked in sales and trading. And that's what I wanted to do growing up, because not for any other reason other than that's what my role models did. I wanted to be like my role models. I didn't even know what it meant to be a trader. But to me, that was a symbol of just wanting to do exactly what the people I cared most about and looked most up to did.
And along those same lines, when you were growing up, you also had this idea that you wanted to be a billionaire someday. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I cared a lot about money. And I think it's because that's just, for whatever reason, how I defined success. I don't know if it was because I grew up in a Wall Street family. I don't know if, you know, it's not even like my family talked about money all that much. Like, I think I was actually pretty sheltered from money, which I think there's positives and negatives of. But for whatever reason, the way that I defined success was money. And so to me, if I want to be the most successful, that in my mind was having the most money. And being a billionaire was, you know, was kind of like the roof of having the most money.
Yeah. I'm curious how you define success today.
Yeah. I mean, how I define success today is by spending as much time as humanly possible on the things that give you energy. To me, I am successful if 90%+ of my time is spent on things that leave me feeling energized, that leave me feeling happy. Obviously, I still care about money, but I would say that what I've realized is money in itself does not give me energy. Money can be a byproduct of doing things that give me energy, but there are also a lot of things I do that give me energy that won't result in money also.
What are some examples?
Spending time with my family, spending time with my girlfriend, spending time talking to my therapist, spending time with friends from college, going on a walk in the woods and not thinking about anything related to work or being productive, right? Like, I think for such a long time, I forced myself to always be doing something that was connected to my professional career, right? So like if I went on a run, I was listening to a podcast. If I, you know, was eating dinner at night, I was watching a YouTube video. And it's not like I don't do those things. I do, but I am trying to be way more intentional about not forcing myself to be productive and to be doing things that give me energy that ultimately lead toward to money. Because I would say that is only one part of my identity, is spending my time on things that give me energy, where money could be the byproduct.
It sounds like a much more intentional way of being in your present day state. Do you know when that shift started to happen?
I think part of it is mental maturity, just getting older. I think part of it is, you know, I would say part of it is from like, you know, past traumas, you know, losing my dad, from, you know, I had a nanny growing up, like a live-in nanny. And, she was basically my second mom growing up because my mom and dad worked all day long. First day of junior year of high school, like 8 armored cars showed up to our house, to basically detain her. She had been an illegal immigrant in the country for 20 years. She was like the most well-valued religious person. And it was one of those things where they came and got her and they were like, we really wish she wasn't here right now, because this is the exact person that we don't want to take out of the country. I would say the combination of that and losing my dad were probably the most traumatic experiences in my life. And I do think shaped how I looked at the world. And it sounds a little cliche, right? Like, you know, you always hear how like traumas lead to like a switch flipping. But I do think, I don't know if it was a switch flipping, but I do think there was a change in perspective, because I think what it made me realize is like so much of the stuff that we're talking about on Twitter on a daily basis, that the news talks about, that like causes a lot of what I would say is just like emotional volatility, whether that's like excitement, shock, anger, frustration on a daily basis. When you pull back and really think about how much am I going to think about that moment a week from now, let alone a year or 10 years from now, you realize how few of those moments there are. And I think those two experiences I just referenced just forced me into a constant pan out mode, where I was constantly saying, why am I getting worked up about this? Why do I truly care about this? And so I think it was the combination of mental maturity, you know, the combination of these life challenges that everyone goes through in some form throughout life. I would just say, you know, I unfortunately have had to go through them pretty early in life. I think it's forced me to really ask the question every time I get worked up about something, or I think something really matters, asking why does this really matter? And by the way, there's pros and cons to that, right? Like the pro is that I think it is starting to force me to go in a direction where I truly spend time on things that really matter, that move the needle in my life, that when I think 30 years in the future, was that time well spent, I will feel really good about it. The downside of that is I think sometimes it can lead me to be actually more stoic or unemotional than I'd like to be. Because if everything is not a big deal in my mind, if, you know, money doesn't matter that much, if this moment in life doesn't matter that much, I think it risks two things. It risks one, me not being reactive, but in a good way. Like sometimes I think it's good to have like, to have emotions in either direction to things, right? Like I don't want to be I don't want to be monotone in my feelings. And I think also sometimes it's not fair to expect that of other people, right? Like it's not fair to expect of my friends or my peers or my colleagues when they're super reactive to moments that I in my head say, come on, this isn't a big deal. Like an hour from now, you're not going to be thinking about this. I think oftentimes like that is a bad habit for my way of being to then project on other people.
It's surprising to hear that from you, because one of the things that I've noticed from you is that you're highly empathetic to other people. So how do you recognize that within yourself? Oh, I'm reacting to others.
Yeah, I think part of it is getting better at the thing that I just spoke about with you, which is not projecting myself on others, because I think empathy is about putting yourself in other shoes. That doesn't mean they're your shoes, means they're other shoes, but you have built up a toolkit that allows you to match as closely as possible in your mind what this person must be feeling right now, right? And so I think I have found ways to build up this toolkit over time. I think part of it is just like, as someone who's obsessed with people, small things add up over time. Like I'll even use the example of people watching. Like I love people watching in airports, in the city. And again, like I don't people watch for the sake of productivity, but I do think there's a skill you build up in constantly watching people, watching the ways that they interact, watching their mannerisms, based on certain emotions. And so I think the reason I'm able to be empathetic is not because I'm the same as everyone. I think I'm able to be empathetic because I've built up this toolkit over time through my own life experiences, through, you know, work with coaches, through work with therapists, through my own obsession with people, that at least allows me to see where they're coming from without judgment. And I think that is the key. It's why I'm not the same as people, while I will not react in the same way as people, non-judgmental observation and understanding of people's perspective is to me what empathy is.
Why do you think you love or enjoy people watching?
I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, some things you can explain why they give you energy. Other things you can't explain why they give you energy. I've always been fascinated by human connection and human experience. And maybe it's because I'm so mind blown by like the vastness of just in an ironic way, the vastness of our world, even though it is such a inconsequential thing in the scope of the entire, like beyond our world. But to me, the fact that when I'm on the street of New York and I'm watching, I was in the city last night and I was at dinner and I saw, you know, probably 30 or 40 different diners outside. And I was fascinated by watching these different dynamics, playing through in my head these stories of what they're talking about, the relationships they have, what they're feeling right now. And I think part of it is I'm obsessed with brains. Like I'm obsessed with how people's minds work, what motivates them, what incentivizes them, what brings them happiness, what doesn't. But I'm also back to the point of vastness. Like I'm mind blown every time I watch these conversations and I'm like, there are literally millions of iterations of these exact conversations happening right now in so many places. And all I'm getting to observe is like literally like the point of a needle of like such a larger thing. So yeah, it's one of those things where like most of the time I can kind of academically or scientifically break down why I'm interested in something, but it's just like, it's also like, why do humans love connection? Yeah, I think there's a physiological reason that can be explained. Like it is what creates safety for us as we go about our lives and try to survive and thrive. So I'm sure there's some like my lizard brain, I think that's what is drawn out. But I think part of it is just like, I don't know. I don't know what it is other than I'm obsessed with thinking about people, watching people, understanding what drives people, and also connecting with people myself.
That makes sense. So going back to the trauma aspect of your life, you know, everyone is going to have some sort of hard time in their life. That's pretty much a guarantee. And you've dealt with multiple situations like that already. What advice do you have for someone going through an incredibly dark period?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is not judging your emotions. I think when you go through a trauma, you experience it and then you judge your experience. So for me, you know, I was incredibly close with my dad, like could not imagine a closer father-son relationship. And after my dad passed away, I cried once. And for several months, I continued to feel unhappiness and anxiety kind of in a derivative form, not from just the loss of him, but from my judging of my experience of the loss, right? From me saying, how could I only cry once when this was my best friend? Why, like, you know, I watch people cry profusely when they're watching a TV show and someone dies. How could this be my experience? And I got to the point where I realized there was nothing productive about that judgment. There was nothing that I was going to, I was trying to seek an unanswerable answer. And I think that's for me has been a really important thing to realize, is knowing when an answer I'm looking to answer is unanswerable. If I continue to try to analyze, I will just be in this vicious cycle that never ends. And the only way to get yourself out of the cycle is realizing that I need to come to peace without an answer. So I'd say that's the first thing, is not judging your emotions and also not holding back emotions. You know, why did I cry once? Again, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. I could break down, you know, maybe it was a function of earlier traumas in life. Maybe it's the fact that I grew up in a household that didn't talk about emotions. Maybe it's the way I'm just biologically wired. But I think disconnecting my emotional response from my connection with my dad was a really important thing. I think the second thing was, again, not projecting what's important on other people. Right? Like my experience in losing my dad reframed everything for me. It created a new anchor of what actual like shittiness meant. Right? So it's like anything bad happens with Morning Brew, anything bad happens in my life, like, you know, we got a new dog, my dog takes a shit on the carpet. Yeah, that sucks. But like it is galaxies away from what I've experienced. And again, like I said, that I think that is a valuable and can be harmful perspective for me to have, right? I think what that allows me to do is have perspective, not overreact to things, realize what truly matters. But if I don't keep that perspective in check and realize it is not fair of me to project it on other people, I think it can be largely unhelpful. So I think that's been a big thing, is realizing that my change in perspective does not give me the permission to expect that change perspective from other people. And I would say the third has been, you know, probably the most cliche, but the most real or true of my experience is how you react in the face of trauma really defines you. So, you know, after my dad passed away, my last 2 years of college were by far and away my most successful. Like I had over a 4.0 my junior and senior year, definitely had below a 4.0 my freshman and sophomore year. Started Morning Brew my senior year after my dad had passed. Morning Brew obviously has had some level of success now. And I think a lot of that was a function of me just saying that there's two options. There's pushing forward or there's sitting back or falling back. And to me, that means there's only one option. And the caveat I will provide of that third learning is that it can be, again, in moderation, a really good thing, but in excess, a really bad thing. What I mean by that is I think it's been a really good thing how the trauma that I experienced acted as a catalyst for my career. But I also think there's negatives of that, right? Because it depends what drives you, right? Like If it was a catalyst of my career because it made me more ambitious than ever before, the question is, why did it make me more ambitious than ever before? Did it make me more ambitious because I was looking for fulfillment more than ever before? Or did it make me more ambitious because I took on the role of the father in my family and I felt a responsibility to now bring in money for my family, because now it was only money out and not money in. And I think if I was to give you like the real and honest answer, it's probably both of those. I think in some ways I was now driven by doing things that actually made me happy, because I experienced firsthand how like life is a lottery ticket, and in good ways and in bad ways, your people hit the lottery, and my dad hit the genetically shitty lottery. And I had, for me, I had no perspective of what was going to happen a day from now, let alone 10 years from now. And so I think that ultimately was the motivator that got me to leave my first job in finance and work on Morning Brew, was this like newfound desire to not spend any more time than I had to doing things that didn't give me energy. But on the negative side, you know, I remember in the hospital room with my dad after basically when, you know, he was in a vegetative state, we were going to pull the plug. And I remember putting my hand on his forehead. He passed away from a stroke instantly, was in perfect shape, like you or me, and just no signs whatsoever. And I remember putting, you know, my hand on his forehead at that point, his hand was cold or his head was cold, and just saying, I'm going to take care of everything. And I think in some ways that was the best and worst thing that I could have done, right? It was the best thing because I think it gave me more drive. It created this fire that no one could manufacture. But it was the worst thing because it was basically me just taking ownership over everything, where now I felt the ownership to take care of my mom, my sister, my grandparents. And to be totally frank with you, in a lot of ways, it was a impractical ownership, because in a lot of ways I came from a background like where I was privileged, where I didn't have to worry about putting food on the table for my family. I was so lucky in that regard. But for whatever reason, me visualizing now that the person who was working so hard to bring money in for the family was no longer around, and all it was me spending money, my mom spending money, my sister spending money, no one working to bring money in, I just assumed that responsibility. And so I think that's the negative part of that third lesson, was it was amazing how driven I became, but I think it was a drive that was partially driven by for the right reasons, or for my true sense of like what gave me energy and alignment with my values. And part of it was driven to take care of my entire family, which potentially wasn't a burden I should have even assumed.
Do you believe you needed to take on that burden to make yourself feel whole?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question also, because I think while I didn't need to assume this burden to actually financially take care of my family, it's tough to, again, go back in time. And I made kind of the conscious or subconscious decisions I made, but I do think there is a very good argument to be made that the way my brain is wired, I would have always felt incomplete if I didn't, you know, have that conversation with my dad, if I didn't assume all these responsibilities. Even though my family would have been fine, I would have felt like I didn't do enough to take care of them. And I think, again, it's tough to weigh what's better or worse, because if you go down kind of like that one permutation of life, you could imagine like maybe that was what was driving anxiety, is like, I'm still at Morgan Stanley, I don't feel like I'm providing enough financial upside for my family. And now what I'm talking about with my therapist is no longer the emotional reaction that I, or lack thereof, that I have with my dad and any of my anxieties around building a business. And now it's, have I done enough to take care of my family?
You're able to shift the responsibility, and that's powerful. How did your plans change when your dad passed away?
So my plans didn't change immediately. I still wanted to be a trader more than ever before. I had my internship. So I remember this. I remember that, I had, the way it works in finance is, you know, you have these like summer analyst and analyst programs. So you, for finance, you would get your summer analyst, you would have your internship after your junior year of college, and you would hope to get a return offer back so that you don't have to recruit for a job senior year, and you just go right to that same job after college. And I remember that I found out that I had received an offer for my junior year internship a week after he passed away. And I think in some ways that almost gave me, made me feel more responsible for accepting the job offer, because he had helped prep me for it. This was still my dream. So I remember accepting the internship offer right after he passed away. I had my internship after junior year in sales and trading. And then senior year is when Austin and I started Morning Brew. But then I graduated from Michigan, and Morning Brew wasn't nearly big enough to go just do that full time. So I graduated, went to Morgan Stanley. And up until that point, again, my plan hadn't changed. The only thing that was different about the plan was Morning Brew was now a thing, and it was just like a side hustle. And I started working at Morgan Stanley full time June of 2015. And I left Morgan Stanley September of 2016. So just over a year later. And I think the point in which I would say the experience of losing my dad actually factored into decisions I made in life was over, call it, this 8-month period that I was working at Morgan Stanley. And I was realizing for myself that I wasn't really enjoying what I was doing. I was getting far more energy from Morning Brew. And I also was realizing for myself that I was doing a mediocre job at both things, and that didn't feel good. And I knew at some point I was going to have to do one or the other, Morgan Stanley or Morning Brew. And where it started factoring into my perspective was I kind of always knew I was going to end up going to do Morning Brew, because in my head, I was just like, what's the worst that can happen, right? Like that, to me, my tolerance for worst case scenarios went up significantly from my dad's loss, right? So for a lot of, you know, my friends or people I know who are still in corporate jobs, the worst case scenario for them is if they go start a startup and it fails, that seems like the worst thing ever. Like their brain doesn't even start thinking about any layers deeper. And I appreciate that perspective, because that is scary. But in my mind, like nothing was scarier than losing my dad. So to me, it was like, you know, it was like a piece of cake. You know, I go start a startup and it doesn't work out. In my head, I just tell myself, I'm going to find a way to make it work. I will get another job. I will network my way into something else. I'll go start another company. I don't think I would have been able to just be so laissez-faire about that if this experience didn't happen to me.
Was it difficult to hand in or quit your job when you come from a family of traders?
It's interesting. I would have expected it to be harder. In some ways, I think it also freaked me out a little bit that I was trading the very same product that my dad traded. So in my head, I was just like, part of the mentality was like, is this literally just like Groundhog's Day, where we're going to look, you know, 20 years from now or 25 years from now, and Alex Lieberman is going to pass away from a stroke after 25 years working in mortgage-backed security trading, being in a super high-stress job, just like his dad was for 25 years before him. So I think, honestly, some of that fear made me feel less bad about it. I think what I also was starting to realize for myself is that there were more jobs out there. Like I literally was like blind to the fact that there were any other jobs in the world other than sales and trading growing up. And I think actually being in the working world, it made me realize there's actually like a lot of other stuff in out there. And I think by working on Morning Brew, it just made me even more aware of that. Like, I think that's like kind of the blessing I got from starting another business and being involved on social, is I think also so many people who are in more traditional roles they don't know what they don't know about there being so many possible jobs in the world they could do now. that didn't exist 5 years ago that they could potentially make just as much money at. Like it's, I think in a lot of cases, people aren't making the decision between this traditional path and this untraditional path. I think a lot of people just don't even realize the untraditional path actually exists. And I think my experience got me to realize more of these paths that existed than I had ever even imagined.
And one of those paths is the creator economy. And I definitely want to touch on that. You've said before that it's day one for the creator economy. Yep. I'm curious why you think that is.
Because I think in some ways, so many of the businesses that we talk about on Twitter are still in their nascency. Like I think the infrastructure has just been built in the last several years for individuals to create a product that a customer consumes from them that they can make money off of and they can control their livelihood. And I think it's so natural now to so many people on Twitter because they're either in the creator economy or they're seeing things like Substack, Patreon, you know, Twitter Spaces, Clubhouse talked about constantly. But I think that is such a narrow aperture of society, of what people actually see. And I think if you were to go to any of your friends from high school and try to have a 45-minute conversation just about Substack, I think the conversation would be over after 4 minutes. And so to me, the reason I think it's day one is because I think the infrastructure now exists. The foundation exists for people to be creators. But I think we are so early in the adoption curve of it. And I think there are still so many businesses or products to not be created yet that will further unlock value or empower individuals to be creators. Like, for example, I still think there's a ton of room to help empower people to go from being employees in a large corporation to being solopreneurs or creators. Like right now, what we say people have to do is just they have to take a leap of faith. And I think there's actually businesses that are going to be built around the leap of faith to de-risk people in being creators. And think about how many hundreds of thousands of people that could be unlocked to become creators if something mitigates that risk beyond just saying, hey, you have to take the leap of faith.
How do you go about creating that leap of faith for people? Like if you were a business, how would you go about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are a few people trying to do these things. I think one is skill development, right? So giving people the tools that they need that they didn't have before to have more confidence to take the leap of faith, right? So I think there's two things. You can either make people way more confident when they take the leap of faith, or you can remove the leap of faith. So to me, things like David Perrell's Rite of Passage or Dickie Bush's Ship 30 for 30, which are both writing courses, but these types of education exist, skill development exists, not just for writing, for podcasting, for video editing, for software creation. To me, that is a way where you build up a skill that makes you way more confident about going to create product when you take the leap of faith. Then I think there's opportunity in staking new creators to remove the leap of faith. So one guy that I know that's doing this is this guy, Jonathan Hillis, who started something called the Creator Fellowship. He has creator cabins. Basically, that is situated like Lambda School, where you get an advance so that when you are worried when you're going to leave your job that's, say, making, I don't know, $75,000 a year, you're worrying to yourself, how am I going to pay rent? How am I going to pay for food? Well, if all of a sudden someone comes to you and says, hey, I'm going to pay for all that stuff for a year. And for that year, you don't have to worry about your cost of living. You can just create great shit. And the agreement is that as you start making money, I'm going to get X percent of that until my investment is paid back, or three times my investment is paid back. That's the risk I'm taking. But what I'm hoping to do for you is by giving you this advance, now you don't feel like you're taking a leap of faith. You feel like you're taking a step. And I think that is just one example of ways that entrepreneurs are going to try to remove the leap of faith for creators. Because when I look at creators, that, you know, they're amazing creators on the internet, but it's almost the same thing that I think about with like professional sports, where I'm always like, there's someone better than LeBron James out there. There's someone better than Tiger Woods in his heyday. They just either didn't know their God-given talent, or they didn't have the opportunity or the risk mitigation to be able to spend as much time and take as much risk in life as they did to find that opportunity. I think the same thing exists in the knowledge economy.
I've never thought about it like that, how Tiger Woods is Tiger Woods because of the abuse that he took as a child from his dad, and no one else has taken that abuse. So yeah, that's really interesting to think about.
Again, like, obviously they're the best athletes in the world, but I just think, even you think about the best podcasters in the world, right? Whoever, Tim Ferriss, you know, Joe Rogan, whoever it may be, Guy Raz, they are incredible. I believe there's someone who's not doing podcasting right now out there who is a more, who is a better podcaster, who has better God-given skills, who potentially has a better work ethic, who doesn't even realize this is an opportunity, or doesn't have the opportunity to take the risk to create podcast content for years on end.
Podcasting too is so new and infancy, right? Yeah. Like, you look at someone like Joe Rogan, 11 years, Tim Ferriss, 7 years, like, they're babies in the grand scheme of things. But you mentioned How I Built This and Guy Raz, and I know that you were just on it. What was that experience like as someone who's a fan of the show and then goes and gets featured on it just 6 years after starting Morning Brew?
It was awesome. You know, on my own podcast, it was very meta. On my own podcast, I reflected on this podcast. And what I basically said is, I said it was an awesome experience, but also kind of like the competitive part of me was like, I was in the minor leagues or on the B team of How I Built This, because I was part of the Resilience series, not the actual main show, similar to like Masters of Scale. Was just on Masters of Scale, but it was Masters of Scale, or actually I can't even remember if How I Built This was Resilience series or Masters of Scale was, but either way, both shows, I was on the B team, not the A team. And I half joke about that. I half don't. Like, I half joke about it because it was an unbelievable experience. Like, you know, how lucky am I and my co-founder to be on like the biggest stage of podcasting? But then part of me is like, no, like, I want to be back on the main stage at some point soon. Like, I don't want to be the opening act. I want to be the main act. I also had an appreciation of Guy Raz's ability more than I did when I started listening to the show, because now as just like someone who has grown up in media now and also is doing a podcast myself, I have such an appreciation for this combination of preparedness, but like also improvisation and off the cuff reaction that's really important, so it doesn't come off as robots talking to robots, and the ability to ask questions that make you think hard and that you haven't been asked before, that make you leave a podcast feeling like you learned for yourself rather than just talking for the sake of talking. I appreciated that because I think 95, maybe even a higher percent of podcasters go for question, answer, question, answer, question, answer. And I think where the true art comes in is asking never before asked questions, questions that make the interviewee feel like they learned in the conversation. Maybe they broke a little bit of a sweat. And also where there were things asked that the interviewer wasn't planning on asking because they're quick enough on their feet and quick enough with their brain to realize that there's an opportunity to ask something that wasn't planned in the beginning.
What did Guy Raz ask you that made you break a sweat?
Oh my God. What did he ask us that made us break a sweat? I would say one thing that he asked that is always is difficult to answer is the way that anytime, like, I've seen this discussed on Twitter. I've never seen it seen us ask this on an interview. Anytime we're asked about like any sort of like political lean, but also how we make money as a business, how like old school media would, you know, maybe not approve of the way that we make money, where like we have native ads in our newsletter. It feels very similar to the writing of any of our stories because it's written with the same tone, and traditional outlets would not approve of that. They would say that there is not enough separation of church and state. And his question basically asked, are you okay with that? Why do you feel okay about not having this separation between advertiser and your editorial, like the media companies of old? Again, I don't think he was like trying to make Austin or I screw up in the interview. I think he was just genuinely curious, right? Like, I think that that is the best type of interview, is where you're asked really hard questions that make you sweat or make you think differently, not because the interviewer is trying to stump you or make you look shitty in front of an audience, but because they are genuinely so curious that this is where their curiosity led them.
Yeah, so true. I'd like to talk about a quote you have, which is, I am more convinced than ever that great storytelling is the crystal key to being successful in business. My question to you is, how do you get better at storytelling?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'm interested to hear if you agree with that or not.
I do.
Because by the way, as I wrote this, I thought to myself, there are going to be a lot of people who don't agree with this. There are going to be a lot of people who think like product knowledge, engineering, like product excellence is the number one skill. And I've thought a lot in my head of, is that a valid argument? And I don't think there's one right answer. But look, to answer your question, first of all, the reason, just to give a little bit more context, but behind 280 characters, the reason that I think storytelling is the crystal key to being successful in business is because when I think about, I think the hardest part of a business is getting from zero to one. And I think in zero to one, when you think about how much storytelling you're doing, or like what are the biggest moments in the business, storytelling connects to those things, right? So in the early days of our business, what were the biggest moments? It was our first hire. It was raising money. It was getting our first big advertiser. All of those are examples of great storytelling. Convincing Discover Card to spend money with us when no one knew who Morning Brew was. Why in God's name would a massive brand trust us with their money? Our first big hire, when we didn't have a foundation, when it wasn't clear that we were going to be a business a year from now, how could we possibly pull off that person deciding to work for us when we didn't have a clear healthcare plan or 401k plan in place? And then what was the last one I said? It was big hire, big advertiser, and raising money. Convincing 28 people to all put money into this business that at the time had never raised before. We were never founders before. We had no business model. All we had was 30,000 subscribers to an email newsletter when email was not considered to be a viable business. To me, that's all storytelling, all of that. And it's different from bullshitting. I think it is the connection of vision, confidence, and planning. How can you get better at storytelling? I think so much of it is practice. And I think it's, you know, the old adage, practice makes perfect. I think it's perfect practice makes perfect, where it is being so incredibly aware of little tweaks you can make every single time you're storytelling. And, you know, for me, I think the reason it comes so naturally is growing up, my dad, like I said earlier, my dad and I had the closest relationship, but he was incredibly hard on me. Everything from correcting my posture to anytime I said like or he would tell me not to say like or Like, I was trained to articulate clearly at a very young age. And now in retrospect, it was like the greatest gift he could give to me. At the time, I thought he was an complete asshole for it. I think it's a lot of practice. I think it's also adopting a, I don't give a shit mentality, or adopting like a, I've been here before mentality, right? Like, I think, and it's a good thing and it's a bad thing, but there's always a proper level of nerves. And I think the way you maintain that proper level of nerves is by spending enough time preparing, such that you like when you spend time preparing, you realize that it's a big moment, right? Because you've spent time preparing. But then I think it's the like, this isn't that big of a deal, or I don't give a shit mentality, that doesn't tip the scale from like nervous to nerves that lead to like degradation of quality of your ability to storytell. And for me, like as ridiculous as it sounds, whenever I'm talking to a big person, or I'm speaking to a big group, or I'm speaking to like a billionaire, all I continue to say myself is, just because they have $1 billion doesn't mean they're endlessly fulfilled. That big group of people I'm talking to, all of them have fears and anxieties. That group of executives that I'm telling about the future of media, yeah, they've been in industry for 25 years, but their businesses are being disrupted by businesses like mine. And it's almost, I would say most of the time I'm pretty humble. I'm not overconfident, but I actually like forcing myself into overconfidence when I speak, because I think it allows me to operate in a zone of what I call like, you know, nervous equilibrium.
Mm. I want to go back to your dad correcting your posture and correcting your language. If you ever have a child or children in the future, what level of discipline will you give them compared to how your dad raised you?
I mean, I'm already correcting our puppy on his posture. it's so tough, right? Because I'm not a parent. I understand. I'm not a parent, but I'm close enough to parenting where I know how difficult it is and how, and what good parenting looks like versus bad parenting. And I give so much credit to great parents that molded, you know, their children into well-valued people. And I also know that there's like situations in life where just because someone's not a good parent doesn't mean they're not a good person, right? They could have been in a situation where they didn't have the foundation or the things they need at the time to be a quality parent. Maybe they weren't parented in the right way, so they didn't have the tools themselves to parent. So now if I fuck it up, I have no excuse, given I'm so grateful for how well my parents parented me. The answer is, I don't know. I know what I want to happen, right? Like I want my children to have a deep sense of the values that matter most, the importance of family, the importance of giving, the importance of integrity and doing the right thing. And also I want my kids to have a deep sense of self, a deep confidence in who they are and what they stand for. To me, that's like in like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If that was like that for parenting, that would be the foundation. To me, what you're talking about is one level above the foundation, right? Like correcting on posture, the things you say. Not that that's not important, but even if my child had an amazing sense of value and an amazing sense of self, and they didn't have great posture, I would still be wildly fulfilled. And so that's why I don't know the answer, because I think until I'm actually in the moment of parenting, I actually won't know how much that matters to me. All I know what matters to me right now is this first part of the pyramid.
Okay, so let's talk about the first part of the pyramid. How would you advise someone to get a better understanding of themselves?
Yeah, I like the question, because I actually think growing up, I didn't have a good sense of myself. Because You know, like I was a very self-conscious kid, and I don't think it was misparenting by my parents. I think it was one, the way I was wired, but also because of the environment around me. You know, like I went to a private school in New Jersey from third grade to 12th grade. And I was one of the youngest people in my grade. My graduating class was 120 people. And most people were a year older than me. They had been held back. And I think a function of me not having mental maturity, people above me just being more developed mentally, socially, I always had this self-consciousness of asking myself, am I cool enough? Do I actually belong in the group? Do girls like me? Am I smart enough? And I think what exacerbated this was the age difference. It was also the fact that I went to the school where it was like, you know, the average student at the time, SATs were 2,400, like the average student got a 2,250 and also a scholarship to Yale for soccer. And so like, that was the comp for me. And so I did not have a good sense of myself because like, I did not feel like I belonged. I did not feel like I was cool or handsome. And I think part of, you know, what gave me a sense of myself was finding a group of people that I truly liked because I liked them, not because I thought the outside world perceived them as like the cool group of people to like. So like I found that in college, which I think was huge for me. I think also totally changing my surrounds, like almost like not being in this vicious cycle of being with the same people for 9 straight years. This new context, I think, helped me a lot. And then I think it was wins that gave me momentum, right? Like in high school, I was just like an average player on the soccer team. I was an average student. At Michigan, it was like I started getting really good grades. I got into the business school. I got a great internship. I got a girlfriend. And those things, it's in a weird way, because I had been wired by, I think, my young years to require external validation for a sense of self. I actually needed external things to validate me, right? Like those were all external things, me getting into the business school, me getting a girlfriend. But it was those external wins gave me a sense of momentum where I got a sense of myself. I actually think I'm still looking to have the best sense of myself. And the next transition I hope to make is where it's sense of self driven by external validation to sense of self driven by internal validation. I don't think I fully made that journey yet. And that's what I'm trying to figure out. And so to your original question, you know, how can you find a sense of self? Honestly, I actually don't know how to teach that. I think, I'm sure there is a way. I'm sure there are things, there are exercises you can do early in life with children or, you know, kids in middle school or high school to be less focused on what others think and more focused on the things you're doing and the joy you get out of it. I don't know what those things are right now, but all I can talk about is my experience. And my experience was time and mental maturity and growth and a new context and a group of people that I actually liked and felt supported by that I think acted as the foundation for me to feel a sense of self. And again, I'm still on that journey, but I feel like I went from no sense of self to sense of self through external validation. And I hope to get to a place where it's sense of self through some combination of external and internal validation. Cause I don't think it's realistic for most human beings on planet Earth to have their sense of self exclusively driven by things that internally validate them.
How are you planning on closing that gap?
I think one way is through, this is a Cat Cole adage, but diversifying your purpose portfolio. And what I mean by that is Morning Brew has been my identity for the last 6 years, like 95% of it. And I think what I always assumed is it has to be my whole identity if I'm fully in the business, like if I'm more committed than ever before. And I think that was just like a fallacy that I convinced myself of. I think I can be 100%, 110% in the business, motivated, doing better than ever before, but only have my purpose portfolio be taken up, you know, 25% by Morning Brew. And so I think one of the ways I do this is finding kind of the other parts of this portfolio that make me feel whole, that aren't driven by subscriber numbers, revenue numbers, social media following. Like those are all external validators. And to me, what I think about is, what are the parts of my purpose portfolio that the one metric is my feeling of joy and not any metric that exists outside of my body? So it's like, if one part of my purpose portfolio becomes giving or becomes community service, like one thing I'm really passionate about is, how do you find a way to end homelessness in New York City? It's like, if I start spending a lot of time on that, if the thing that makes me feel fulfilled about that is the work that I am doing on this journey to try to end homelessness, and I don't feel motivated to post it on social media, virtue signal at all, like I will know that is some, one part of my purpose portfolio that is kind of being guarded by external validation.
It's so interesting that you mentioned not posting about it, because I was watching a video yesterday where someone was saying how the amount of time someone posts about their relationship on Instagram is correlated negatively to the actual love in the relationship. And I don't know if that's true. I just thought it was really interesting. And it touches on exactly what you're talking about,
it's an interesting point you bring up, right? Because literally today on Instagram story, I posted a picture at my sister's birthday dinner of me, my sister, my sister's boyfriend, my mom, and my girlfriend. And as I posted that, I asked myself, why am I posting this? I asked myself, am I posting this because I want others to see this? Am I posting it because I view Instagram as my life's time capsule? Am I posting this because I think it's a really good picture and I don't give a shit, I just want to post it? And I think it's a hard answer, right? Because if I think I'm being totally emotionally or intellectually honest with myself, there's some part of me in there, like what, and I think most people just wouldn't admit this, but there's clearly some part of me that is adding it to my Instagram story because I care about other people seeing it, right? Otherwise, I would just have a shared iPhoto album with my family doing that. And so I asked myself that exact question today, why I did that. And I don't know if that's going to change my behavior in a meaningful way moving forward, but I do think it's really important to ask that question to yourself.
How do you get the self-awareness that you clearly have?
I genuinely think like self-awareness is a very difficult thing to teach. I think most things are teachable. I think self-awareness, I think you can teach it through mindfulness, where by making sure people are not letting life happen to them, but they are experiencing life and they're experiencing it on their terms at their speed, such that they have the space to ask questions or to be observant without judgment. I think that's one way. I think the other way is like, I recently posted a thread on independent thinking. And I think one of the greatest ways you can be an independent thinker is also one of the greatest ways you can be self-aware, which is asking why. Like the more you can ask why you're doing something or why someone's experiencing something that way, the more you can, I think, be really honest with yourself about what drives your decisions, the way you interact with people, right? So it's like, even, you know, if I got in an argument with my girlfriend and in the moment I'm like, she's wrong. I did all these things. But then a moment later, if I ask myself, you know, why did that actually just happen? Why did I react in this way? Why did my brain default to blaming her? Oftentimes, I think what you realize by asking the question why, just like there aren't many right answers in life, there are just trade-offs of many possible right answers. I think you find the same thing in like social situations or emotional feelings, is that there's this T table of pros and cons or plus and minuses or, you know, happiness and frustration. And so I think by asking why, it forces emotional and intellectual discovery, and it forces you to take the time to do that.
Why do you think you've been so open and honest with your own story?
I think part of it is that's just like my default being now. I think it's a competitive advantage. I think vulnerability and sharing is a competitive advantage for two reasons. One, people have less shit on you. Two, people, I think, are attracted to. I think vulnerability and sharing is a magnet for other people, because I think a lot of people, one, want to know what it's like in your world. People want to see what it's like in other people's worlds. They want to be the fly on the wall. But I think it also normalizes experiences for people, right? Like when I talk about going through my own loss or being bullied in middle school or high school, or worried about not being attractive to girls, or like all of these things, I think the reason people are also attracted to it is because, like me, I experienced a lot of these things, not knowing if they were normal or not normal. And the more I've gone through things in life, the more I realize I am so not exceptional. I'm so not the minority in my experiences. And so to me, the reason I think vulnerability and sharing is a magnet is because most of the things I share in terms of my experiences, I think my experiences are wildly unoriginal. And I think that brings a sense of calm to people who hear them.
Would you recommend others take that level of openness and honesty to their own lives? What are the disadvantages?
I think one of the disadvantages is you have to make sure the people in your life are okay with it, right? Like I'm talking about my girlfriend, I'm talking about my mom and my family. Not everyone wants their life to be so public, right? There are absolutely downsides of being public. But your question was less about building up a personal brand and being public and more so just like sharing. I think one is potentially regretting, right? Like sharing something in a really open and vulnerable way and realizing after the fact that you didn't actually want to share that and you don't feel great about sharing that. There's no way to remove that, right? So it's that you can't delete the internet. I think that is absolutely a downside. And that's something I've come to terms with. I haven't had a regret yet. I can only speak about my own experience. I haven't had a regret yet of being open and being vulnerable. I think the upside obviously is vast, which we just spoke about. Yeah, to me, the biggest thing is I think you really need to, I wouldn't tell anyone or everyone, hey, you should be like me and be super vulnerable and literally put your journal on the internet. Because I don't think everyone feels comfortable with that. And I think also people have other ways of, like, to me, I think it's therapeutic, right? I think it is a way when I talk through these things, I attract other people who experience these things, right? So it's like when I talk about me experiencing OCD, I get dozens of people who also experience OCD that I didn't know yesterday that now I can talk to normalize my experience. But there are other ways to work through the things that matter to you, the things that give you anxiety, the things that light you up versus than doing so just in a public forum, right? So this is just one, I would say just one way of expressing yourself. It has worked for me because I think it is at the intersection of personal fulfillment and professional development and professional success, but not everyone needs to connect their personal fulfillment and their personal sharing and journey through emotion and vulnerability to what makes them successful professionally.
Yeah, that certainly makes a lot of sense. Alex, this has been an incredible conversation. Is there anything else you'd like to add Any topics you'd like to explore before we wrap it up?
Do you have any feedback on my podcast?
No, I don't. Have you listened to it at all? No, I haven't.
Can I tell you about it for a sec?
Please.
So I started a podcast right at the beginning of the pandemic. It's called Founders Journal. And the whole concept, and it just ties into what we were talking about, which is I always growing up wanted to journal. And not just growing up, in my professional career. Because I have this view that there was one, like I would say commercial side of me, one emotional side of me. The commercial side of me was like, why am I not documenting everything? Because I can end up writing a book and it's going to be so much harder when I don't have this documented. The personal or emotional side of me is like, half of my life from 21 to I don't know, whatever age is going to be working. And they're going to be such amazing experiences. And when I use the word amazing, I actually don't mean like great, amazing, like experiences that lit me up and experiences that caused me to feel my most anxious self. And to me, when I'm 60 years old, what a shame it would be to not remember those. And this is one thing that I've realized in the last 8 years since my dad passed away is memory is way worse than we think it is. Like one of my actually like just biggest anxieties or frustrations is I have a lot of trouble remembering specific moments with my dad. And what I think to myself is how amazing it would have been if I had far more of these moments documented in some way. And so I think about that in all parts of life. But professionally anyway, I started journaling, like writing in a journal. And for whatever reason, I could not build the habit. I just could not get myself. Every time I would get to like 5 days of journaling, it wouldn't work. I would get out of the habit. And so what I said to myself is if I start journaling in front of the world, then maybe that will be the accountability that I need to build in to force me to do that. And so I started as a daily podcast over a year ago. We're 180 something episodes in, and now it's 3 days a week. We're doing more scripting and things like that. But the whole idea is this podcast is for people building businesses, whether it's a startup with a team, a solopreneur, an entrepreneur in a company. And my view is like, no one has done a really effective podcast about the mindset you need to build well. And to me, it was this perfect marriage of like, I can give people the tools around the mindset you need to build by just sharing my experiences, all of my most provoking and interesting thoughts behind the scenes of building a business and experiencing other businesses. And so now Founders Journals, you know, 100 something episodes in, talk about everything from like, what it's been like to work with Austin as my co-founder and picking a co-founder to firing our first employee to also, you know, me studying different businesses like Pinduoduo is the most recent one, which is an unbelievable e-commerce business no one's ever heard of, but there are so many amazing things we can learn and think about in building our own things. So that's been an awesome exploration for me.
How has being forced to codify your thinking in that way 3 or 5 times a week, how has that changed your perceptions and your managerial style at Morning Brew?
I would say that I don't know if it's changed my managerial style, except for the fact that I think it actually just gives more insight for people in our company into how I think. So like, I don't think my actions have changed, but I think others' perceptions of me has changed. Because, you know, when I'm talking about this journal, everything from my dad's death to what it was like, the emotional state I had when letting an employee go, to also just like thinking about interesting things like network effects or switching costs, interesting business strategies. I think unintentionally, I didn't think of this as like a branding tool for me originally, but I think it kind of creates this idea of like, Alex is curious, Alex is empathetic and emotional just through my own experience. And so I do think it's this interesting thing where I never thought about it as almost like employer branding, but I think in some ways Founders Journal is an exceptional tool for employer branding for Morning Brew, for people who want to work at the company, now more than ever, when I interview people or like people interview, they talk about listening to Founders Journal first. So that has been like a very interesting byproduct, unintended consequence of starting this.
And you mentioned in a different interview where you can't possibly get to know every person like you did at the start.
Yep.
You know, and so Founders Journal is probably an incredible way for people to have that connection to you.
Exactly. And I think Founders Journal is an exceptional way for people to connect with me without synchronously connecting with me. And that's also one of the beauties of like the internet and social media, right? Is just the fact that I can share my lessons with our whole company, but also millions of possible people who could work at our company in the future without knowing them. But also if they want to get to know me, they have the ability to get to know me by sharing their thoughts and attracting my thoughts.
What's been the most surprisingly challenging thing about Founders Journal?
So most people would say just cranking out the content, but I'm used to that. Like we put out Morning Brew for 6 years straight. Like I love creating content. I love this journey of nonstop, just thinking of content and writing content. And it's a grind, but I love the grind. I think the hardest thing for me has actually been striking this balance of it's supposed to be a journal, right? So it's supposed to be reflective, imperfect, raw, but I also want it to have value where someone leaves it feeling like they have learned one thing that has changed their way of thinking. And so it's this tough balance where I'm scripting more now, I'm researching and preparing more, but I don't want it to come off as scripted and prepared. And so that is actually the biggest struggle I'm having is if I read from the script, it sounds like I'm reading from a script. If I just totally do it off the cuff, I worry about not actually taking this very circular route of teaching a lesson. And so I'm still trying to find this in between where it's scripted enough to keep me on track, but not scripted so much that I sound like a robot and I'm not actually journaling.
It sounds like Guy Raz will be great to talk to for that respect, going full circle in the conversation.
Exactly.
Where can people find more from you, Alex?
These days trying to build up Twitter. Business Barista, you just look up Business Barista on Twitter. You can find me there. Otherwise would love for you to take a listen to Founders Journal. You just look it up on any of the major podcast players, Spotify, Apple, look up Founders Journal and, would love for you to listen and follow me.
Awesome. Well, thank you for the time and thank you for the incredible insights, conversation and look into your heart. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hope you guys enjoyed that conversation with Alex Lieberman. If you did, or you have any thoughts or feedback about the episode, let me know on Twitter at @HeyDannyMiranda. Thank you for listening. From the bottom of my heart, it means the world to me, and I really, really appreciate you. Have a great one, and I'll see you guys in the next one. Peace.